WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, and we will keep following developments in the presidential transition now and the Democratic and protest movement response. Good morning, everyone. One question, how much will the Democrats in Congress play ball with Trump versus just saying no to everything so as not to normalize someone they consider to be morally unfit to hold office as someone who enables racism and misogyny? Here's one way the Democrats in Congress are dealing with Trump. It's to try to hold him to the more progressive populist promises he made during the campaign. This is Senator Bernie Sanders, who was on this program yesterday, saying the Senate Democrats are making a list.
Now, one of the things that we are going to do is to research, and we're doing it right now, every bloody statement that Donald Trump made during his campaign, every promise that he made about all of the things that he wants to do. And you know what? We're going to hold him accountable. He talked about taking on Wall Street. He talked about protecting Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. He talked about rebuilding the infrastructure. He talked about being a quote-unquote champion of the working class. We are going to hold him accountable, and we're going to bring people together to demand that when he speaks about the needs of working families, when he speaks about the needs of high unemployment rates in minority communities, that he actually fulfills what he said.
Bernie Sanders here yesterday. One interesting thing about that strategy, it could wind up with Trump and the Democrats in Congress on one side of some important issues and the congressional Republicans, led by Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, on the other. So let's start there and bring on our first guest, NPR political correspondent Sarah McCammon. Hi, Sarah. Thanks for coming on one little NPR station individually like this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning. Thank you.
So how much does what Senator Sanders said there in that clip reflect an emerging Democratic strategy? The New York Times has an article exploring a similar question today, though put as less of a challenge than the way Sanders sounded. Senate Democrats' surprising strategy was the headline, trying to align with Trump. Is that what you see happening?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, it seems like there are a couple of ways that Democrats can respond to Trump's election. And one thing we've heard a lot from critics of Trump is, again, this idea that he can't be normalized, that the kinds of comments he's made throughout his candidacy, things about women, about immigrants, about Muslims, about Mexicans are beyond the pale and should not be normalized. At the same time, Donald Trump is now the president-elect. And so the reality is that Democrats and also Republicans who may have concerns about Trump have to decide how to respond to him and have to work with him to govern. So I think what you're hearing from Bernie Sanders is one response. I want to point out, though, that we're also hearing criticism of Trump from Sanders. You know, he put out a statement yesterday criticizing the choice of Steve Bannon, formerly of Breitbart News, which has been a platform for a lot of, for white nationalist ideas and for ideas that a lot of people find racist, misogynistic, et cetera. Steve Bannon was chosen as Trump's chief strategist. Bernie Sanders has called for him to step aside or be removed from that position.
Right. So in fact, let me jump in and play a clip of Harry Reid, the outgoing Democratic leader, saying the same thing.
He appointed a man seen as a champion of white supremacy as a number one strategist in the White House. If Trump is serious about seeking unity, the first thing he should do is rescind his appointment of Steve Bannon. Rescind it. Don't do it.
So we've got Harry Reid going that far. We've got Bernie Sanders going that far. Anybody else?
Well, you know, I think a lot of Democrats, a lot of certainly liberal-leaning people are very concerned about Steve Bannon's appointment. At the same time, he's been with the campaign for months now, so this isn't exactly new, but it is elevating him to really an official position by having him serve in the White House. And, you know, I've been talking with some of my Republican sources because I primarily covered the Republican – I primarily cover Republican politics. I covered the Republican primary and then the Republican nominee. And what I'm hearing from, you know, folks like Ralph Reed, you know, evangelical leaders who, you know, eventually did come around to supporting Trump is – hey, you know, Bannon was chosen because he's a good manager. You know, we shouldn't read a lot into it. So I think you're hearing a lot of, from the Republican side, a lot of sort of at least minimizing of some of the things that Bannon has done in the past. But I think you'll continue to hear criticism from Democrats, keeping an eye on things that he says and does. That being said, to get back to your original question about Bernie Sanders and the approach the Democrats in Congress are taking, I think you're hearing kind of both approaches from Sanders, right? You're hearing this criticism of Trump and Bannon, and at the same time, this idea that, look, there are some issues we can work together on, things like trade, things like potentially child care, something that Trump's daughter Ivanka Trump has really pushed. Of course, there are lots of different ways to address those issues and lots of different philosophies that can come to bear as you figure out what, you know, how to translate those goals into policy. But yeah, that could be an opportunity for Democrats to maybe get some things done that they wouldn't normally be able to get done with a Republican president in office or even a Democratic president.
And here's another option for dealing with Trump on the part of progressives that I wonder if you're hearing at all from actual Democratic officials in Washington. I talked off the air yesterday to a couple of progressive writers who seem to hate the whole idea of what you were just describing there that Democrats are looking at, those areas of common ground, or that Bernie Sanders laid out in that clip from yesterday's show. I'm not going to name these writers because they haven't written this yet, and I think they're still formulating their actual positions. But they were kind of revolted by the idea that Senate Democrats might normalize Trump and Steve Bannon and the bigotry and misogyny they represent by aligning with Trump on anything in a business-as-usual kind of way. They were saying like, oh, so I can get an infrastructure bill? I'm going to treat this man as a normal president? No, of course, they're not in office. But I wonder if you're hearing any strains of objections like that in Washington yet.
Well, again, I primarily cover Republicans, but I think if you just, you know, if you look at the conversations that are being had, pieces that are being written, certainly conversations on social media, you know, you do hear that. And I mean, I can only speak to what I've heard from people. And, you know, I wrote a piece about Mike Pence, you know, vice president-elect this week. You know, one person said, how can you possibly normalize him? You know, and I've really just written about him. And so I think you're going to hear that from a lot of Democrats, just this idea that, you know, there's a big adjustment happening here to even adjust to the reality that for Democrats that Mike Pence is the president-elect, that Donald Trump, I'm sorry, the vice president-elect, that Donald Trump is the president-elect. And it is, I think, a conundrum for a lot of folks what to do. But at the same time, the reality is, again, Republicans control Congress. They will control the White House. They may have very soon more control of the Supreme Court. So, you know, it's I don't know what Democrats can do. I suppose they could. You know, refuse to confirm appointments, and they could take a hard line, really a tactic that Republicans have often done in the other direction to President Obama. But I think the question is, you know, just how pragmatic do they want to be?
Right.
Are they able to be? And where do they draw a line in the sand? I mean, are we going to have 4 years of absolutely nothing getting done, or is this a chance to get, you know, maybe get something done? And that's not a question I can answer.
No, you're a journalist framing what's going on down there. And listeners, when we're done hearing Sarah's report and taking some calls on a variety of things on the transition, we're going to do a call-in a little later in the hour specifically on this question. If you're a Democrat or if you're just a, you know, politically progressive American, do you want the Democrats to do business with Trump to get some things done that you like policy-wise, or would you rather they just sit down at their seats? You know, maybe all the Democratic members of Congress should just have a sit-in on the Capitol steps every day until at least Steve Bannon resigns, or maybe until 4 years go by and Trump leaves or has to resign before that for some reason. We'll do that as a call-in in a few minutes after we get through some more of the transition reporting with Sarah McCammon, NPR political correspondent. So to stay on the Democrats, and I want to get to your Pence reporting in a minute, but when we had Bernie Sanders on the show yesterday, a caller wanted to know if Sanders would oppose Chuck Schumer as minority leader because Schumer is so close to Wall Street. But here was Sanders' response.
Chuck Schumer has already won the – we just came from a meeting. I supported Schumer. Schumer will be a very good leader in putting together a diverse caucus. And the point is that right now you have in the caucus some very conservative Democrats, and you have Elizabeth Warren and myself and some other progressives. And I think Chuck will do a very good job in bringing that caucus together.
So just from your impressions, from what you could tell there, Sarah, in the context of your reporting, are there wings of the congressional Democrats, as Sanders suggested, emerging in this post-election nightmare for the party? And are they any different? I mean, we always knew there was going to be a Bernie Sanders-Elizabeth wing. Is it any more of a difference or a different kind of difference than if Hillary Clinton had won?
It's definitely different. I mean, I think if Hillary Clinton had won, you would continue to see some of those fissures that emerged during the primary among the Democrats, you know, the wing that you just alluded to, obviously, the Bernie Sanders, who, of course, we should point out is an independent, but, you know, caucuses with the Democrats and, of course, ran for the Democratic nomination. Senator Elizabeth Warren, you know, they represent the more progressive wing of the sort of the Democratic Party in that sense. And they weren't going to go away, even if Hillary Clinton was elected. I think you would have seen them continuing to push her on some of these issues like trade and like the minimum wage and other issues that were a big feature of Bernie Sanders' campaign. Here, though, we have, you know, a totally different set of circumstances. We have a Republican president who happens to be, you know, Donald Trump incoming. And I think it is interesting, though, that Bernie Sanders is one of the people who's saying, look, let's see what we can get done, because he certainly, you know, he challenged Hillary Clinton to the dismay of many sort of establishment Democrats who, you know, saw his challenge to her as weakening her candidacy. He is certainly not an establishment Democrat. Again, he's not even a Democrat. So and yet he's one who is, on the one hand, criticizing Trump, but also, again, calling for getting, you know, seeing what we can get done going forward. Now, I don't know if that represents sort of the consensus opinion of progressive Democrats. I think at the same time, you know, we're also on the streets seeing a lot of protests. Right. And a lot of I was in New York a week ago or so, out on the streets covering some of those protests. It was a lot of young people, and you know, I haven't done a poll, but I would suspect that there's a big overlap between sort of progressive Bernie Sanders type Democrats and those who were protesting Trump's election. So, you know, is that a message that Bernie Sanders is going to be able to pass on and communicate? You know, are his followers going to accept that kind of a message? I think is a big question, and you'll continue to see those distinctions within the Democratic Party, but. You know, it seems like their biggest battle is going to be figuring out who they are going forward and how do they gear up for 2018 and 2020, and at the same time serve as a check to whatever Trump and the congressional Republicans try to do.
Is Congressman Keith Ellison becoming the consensus choice for Democratic Party chair, or is there a competition underway?
Well, his name is coming up a lot. He was, I think it's worth pointing out, one of the very first Democrats to publicly sort of validate or recognize the idea that Donald Trump's candidacy was a real thing and not just something to laugh at. I mean, I will never forget, I believe it was on ABC with George Stephanopoulos back in July 2015. It was Ellison who said something, made a comment that, you know, Trump could be the GOP nominee, and hear the things he's saying. He, you know, recently announced his candidacy, made the famous comments about Mexican immigrants being rapists and bringing drugs and all of that. And he was laughed at. But he, in a certain sense, had a certain amount of foresight and prescience, you could argue, to recognize that Trump did represent something that was real in the country, for better or worse. And you know, so he's sort of a progressive voice as well.
I've heard I've heard a few commentators here in New York say if the Democrats' failure in the election was connecting with the white working class, an African-American Muslim as party chief doesn't send the right message. Now, that's too reductionist for me. I think it depends on what Keith Ellison does in the job, if he gets the job. But these were a black and a Latino commentator I saw on television here in New York suggest that that might be bad strategy for the Democrats for that reason. Is anyone saying that out loud in Democratic D.C.?
Not that I've heard, although, again, I want to point out that I primarily cover Republicans. Right. So, you know, that's not a question I've really been asking. But, for, you know, from my coverage throughout the primary cycle of, you know, the Democratic race, when I did cover the Democratic primary, it was clear that, you know, the energy was somewhere else besides the Democratic establishment. You know, I mean, Hillary Clinton did have a lot of support. Obviously, she got the most votes and she won the primary and became the Democratic nominee. But the times that I went to, for instance, Bernie Sanders events, you know, there was just an energy and an excitement and lines out the door, kind of like you saw with Donald Trump. So I think there's a real appetite, especially among younger Democrats, for some kind of a change, shaking things up. And certainly after the result of this election, there seems to be an opening for that. You know, whether that's in the form of Keith Ellison or not, I don't know. But the Democrats definitely are going to have to do a lot of soul searching going forward.
NPR political reporter Sarah McCammon with us. We'll take your phone calls in a few minutes. Be patient for a few minutes, folks. And then we're going to open up the phones for Democrats and progressives on that question of doing business with Trump versus just saying no to Trump. We're already getting, you know, a patter going on Twitter just hearing that this question is coming up. And we'll take your phone calls on this in a few minutes after we get through a little more of what's happening in the transition. And right now, a little bit of breaking news. And Sarah, I'm going to throw this one at you. I don't know if you've seen it yet or if you report in this area of Washington at all, but we have a couple of news organizations reporting now, Reuters and CNN, that the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, says he has submitted his resignation. Is this something that you've heard or something that you had any indication might be coming for any reason?
Well, you know, I do know that today the Trump transition team is expected to submit its landing team, which these are basically groups of people that go to major agencies and start laying the groundwork for the transition. And they're going to have, you know, several different categories of landing teams. One of them is domestic policy. One of them is intelligence and foreign policy. And I know that the intelligence team is supposed to be getting going today. So I'm not sure, and I think they're sending representatives to the Department of Justice and to the National Security Council and a couple of other related agencies. So I'm not sure if that's what's connected. I mean, I have heard concerns certainly from people in the military about, you know, what a Trump administration would mean. What does it mean for federal agencies? There's been reports by other news organizations of a rocky transition and a lot of uncertainty at some of these agencies about just who is taking over and what's coming next. Of course, you know, Trump has disputed that, has said that things are going really smoothly. So you can only really speculate. I'm seeing this report as well. And I certainly don't have any behind the scenes intel on what's going on. But, you know, this is a big change that's underway. And you can only speculate about what's going through Clapper's mind.
Now, the NBC News website is saying that this was probably expected, that Clapper has said in interviews with NBC News over the last year that he was counting down the days to stepping down at the end of President Obama's final term. And in testimony to the House Select Intelligence Committee, I guess today, he said submitting the resignation, quote, felt pretty good. So I don't know if this is just an ordinary, you know, I always said I was going to leave at the end of the Obama administration, and now I'm leaving, or if this is Clapper not wanting to have to suffer a new set of slings and arrows. Of course, he, I think, is widely seen as having lied to Congress about the NSA program that Edward Snowden revealed, just flat out lied to Congress. He's been called out for that by members of both parties. And I don't know, and this is, you know, entirely off the top of my head, but whether the fact that there were so many breaches of U.S. cybersecurity during the campaign, you know, even though they were against the Democrats and the Republicans were coming in, that whole WikiLeaks thing purportedly by Russia that seemed to affect the Clinton campaign. I don't know if that's a failure of national security. He was supposed to be the future of cyber war, right?
Well, I mean, he is 75 years old. Ah. So, I mean, you know, we're going to see a lot of changes in the coming weeks. And I think I would just caution, you know, not to read too much into any single change, yeah, because it is a new administration and it is a new party. So it is common, of course, when a new president takes over, especially of the opposing party, to see some changes. I'm seeing a BBC report, though, that says that analysts believe that Clapper was sending a signal to the Trump administration that they need to speed up the transition. And, you know, that's a criticism that we've heard a lot, that this is, you know, taking a while. There have only been a couple of official announcements of cabinet members, of Trump's chief of staff and chief strategist. And there's a lot of speculation about a lot of others and a steady stream of people going in and out of Trump Tower this week. But as of yet, not a whole lot of clarity about who's going to be in charge.
So let me ask you about some of the cabinet member talk. In the basket of deplorables, as far as Democrats are concerned, is Senator Ted Cruz. And now there's buzz about him as attorney general, possibly. Can you tell yet if that's serious?
Well, he was seen meeting with Trump. I mean, he went to Trump Tower a couple of days ago. Obviously, those two were bitter rivals during most of the primary campaign. Let's recall that, Trump retweeted a photo of Ted Cruz's wife, Heidi, an unflattering photo alongside a picture of his own wife, Melania. This was a modeling photo. And there were, you know, lots of bitter back and forth between those two. Ted Cruz was very slow to endorse Trump. Remember, at the Republican National Convention, he got up, gave a speech on the floor, and he said, "Vote your conscience," and was booed off the floor by the convention. So it's only been in really recent weeks, months perhaps, that Cruz did finally come out and endorse Trump. And they seem to be making nice now. Ted Cruz does have, obviously, he's an attorney. He has he was, I believe, Solicitor General or Attorney General of Texas before he was a senator. He's known for his rhetorical skill. Was a college debater. So
Harvard Law. He was a Supreme Court clerk. I think, correct me if I'm just remembering this wrong, that he has argued before the Supreme Court, I think. Maybe as Texas Solicitor General, maybe. And
yes,
he is as Scalia-ish as you can get on the issues and outspoken in a Scalia kind of way. So one could see him as Trump's Attorney General. One could also see him as a Supreme Court appointee, Ted Cruz.
Yeah, I've seen that speculation. I know reporters at Trump Tower have asked some of Trump's aides about that and haven't gotten a lot of answers. Ted Cruz is not on the list of about 2021 Supreme Court picks that Trump put out during the campaign. This was an unprecedented thing to do and really was seen as an effort to shore up his support among, social conservatives and the party base. He put out two different lists of a total of about 20 people that he said, "I will pick from this list for Supreme Court nominations." And those were lists that came from groups like the Federalist Society, really conservative think tanks. And that was something that, as I talked to Republican voters, especially Republican voters who had concerns about Trump and didn't really see themselves before voting for somebody with his temperament and personality and personal history, they said, "But, you know, this is a choice between two candidates. And, he's the one that will pick conservative Supreme Court justices." So Cruz is not on that list, but he would definitely fit the bill. I mean, he is definitely a social conservative, mm-hmm, and has the resume, regardless of policy, he has the resume. So I could see either of those things happening. But, so far it's all speculation.
My producer, Megan Ryan, on the quick research beat, confirms that Ted Cruz has argued before the Supreme Court 9 times with mixed results, according to the Texas Tribune. How's the Rudy Giuliani as Secretary of State thing? Is it falling apart over his business dealings with questionable foreign governments and organizations?
I mean, that's definitely the big objection. he was, at the end of the campaign, though, Trump's most, really most prominent surrogate, you know, after New Jersey Governor Chris Christie sort of fell away in the wake of the Bridgegate scandal. Giuliani was at just about every rally the last couple of weeks and stumping hard for Trump. And, you know, it's clear that Trump wants to reward him for that, in what capacity we will see. But yeah, he obviously has been a very prominent mayor and dealt with 9/11 and all of that. So that argues in his favor, but he doesn't have, in the minds of a lot of critics, certainly doesn't have an unblemished past either.
So you've been reporting this week about Mike Pence's place in the new administration as vice president. Let me play a clip from the rollout of him as running mate in July, and I gather this is part of his stock speech about himself.
I'm a Christian, a conservative, and a Republican, in that order.
I'm a Christian, a conservative, and a Republican, in that order. Can you imagine if Keith Ellison said, I'm a Muslim, a liberal, and a Democrat, in that order? But Mike Pence can say this about putting his particular religion ahead of his place in public civic life. Has anyone in D.C. ever raised that to you as an issue?
I've seen that one of my a Muslim that I follow on Twitter that we follow each other said that very same thing to me. A Muslim activist and someone who writes about Muslim issues said, imagine if I put my religion first. And I think that's a really good point. I mean, we heard a lot of rhetoric in this campaign about this being a Judeo-Christian nation. And we heard a lot of rhetoric from Ted Cruz and certainly from Donald Trump about protecting religious liberty. I actually asked Cruz this question once in the primary, does that extend to Muslims? And he said, of course it does, you know, because under our constitution, it certainly does. I would ask Trump voters the same question, and sometimes they'd stop and think about it for a minute and say, well, sure, you know, as long as they're not forcing it on us. But there is a lot of very, you know, Judeo-Christian-centered rhetoric, and I think it feeds into this sort of larger sense that you saw and heard from a lot of Trump voters that their way of life is eroding and the country is changing quickly, and to many, you know, many of Trump supporters, the sort of the idea of America that they have in their minds is a Judeo-Christian country, and so you know, it gets complicated when you start sort of pressing people on the fact that, well, we have lots of religions in this country and many people who are not religious.
And Pence is known as perhaps the most anti-abortion rights governor in the country. He signed a bill this year that I guess was halted in court, at least for the moment, that had very controversial provisions like banning abortions that were for fetal abnormalities and requiring funerals for fetuses in some cases. He's also anti-gay based on his so-called religious liberty bill in Indiana, allowing businesses to refuse service to gay customers that he rolled back to some degree under pressure. Will he be an activist on these areas as vice president? Do you have an indication?
Well, you know, on the religious liberty bill, he did support the overarching bill, but then he also supported the amendment that was designed to basically roll back some of those provisions a little bit with an eye toward trying to prevent some of these concerns about discrimination against gays and lesbians. And I should point out that Pence got flack from the religious right for his support of that amendment. So in talking with folks in Indiana, I spoke with the Senate Majority Leader, a Republican, who kind of shepherded that bill through and the amendment. You know, he told me that Pence is a good listener, that he, you know, he sort of observed him talking to people on all sides of this issue in Indiana, and you know, whether or not he agrees, he says he is able to listen and work across the aisle. I mean, Indiana is a pretty red state, though, so it's a different world than Washington. And we'll have to see how that translates to the big stage that he's now on.
Let me take one phone call before you go, because Jim and Brick is raising a question that keeps coming up here in the last few days, and we'll do a separate segment on it in a few days. But since you're there in Washington reporting, and my guest is NPR's Sarah McCammon, political reporter, Jim, I'm going to let you ask the question and see what Sarah says about how much this is swirling around D.C. like it's swirling around the Internet. Hi, Jim.
Yes, good morning, Brian. Yeah, it's hard to phrase, so bear with me. What I heard that the Electoral College results are certified on December 19th. And, how viable is the opening for the to prevail upon the delegates or electors to become unfaithful, is it, or faithless electors?
Right, meaning not...
To deny these 270 minimum to 269. Not that they would convert their vote to another of the nominee or candidates, but if it were, if the electoral number were below 270, it would kick over to the House of Representatives.
Well, if it was a tie at 269, I believe is when it kicks over to the House of Representatives, and that's what the two, I think it's two electors from Washington State, have said that they want to do. They feel that they can't vote for Trump in good conscience. Although I think Washington State went for Clinton, but they don't want to vote for Clinton. They would write in somebody or vote for somebody who couldn't get the actual election in the Electoral College, with the notion of throwing it into the House of Representatives in the hopes that the House would pick another Republican, but not Donald Trump. And then there's a change.org petition, which last I saw has over 4 million signatures, which is more than any other change.org position in the history of change.org positions, from what I read, again, trying to get some kind of change in the Electoral College before the December 19th vote. Now, Sarah, I have a hard time believing that there's any possibility that this is actually going to happen, either of those things. But are they talking about this?
I have seen those petitions, too, and you're right. They have millions of signatures. But no, I mean, we have a process for electing a president, and Trump clearly and resoundingly won in the Electoral College. Yes, he lost the popular vote, but this has happened before, and this is the process that we have. So I think the chances of the enough electors deciding to, you know, radically violate the system that we have in place is very unlikely. And I think you have to imagine if the shoe were on the other foot, if the same talk were happening and Hillary Clinton had won the Electoral College, there would be outrage. So that's not welcome news, I know, to opponents of Donald Trump, but it's where we are.
And where we are is at the end of our time with NPR political correspondent Sarah McCannon. Thanks so much for giving us time in a one-on-one here as you go back to reporting for the hundreds, thousands, millions of public radio stations around the country.
Thank you so much. Happy to do it.